Talk to you this morning about the dangers of being too spiritual. You may feel there's not much risk of that while the Christmas pudding still lingers in the digestive tract. Or you might feel that's a rather unexpected and even slightly reprehensible thing for a minister to want to talk about. Surely it should be every Christian's ambition to be as spiritual as possible. Well, nevertheless, I feel I'm on strong ground this morning talking to you about this subject because the Apostle Paul is dealing at Corinth, here in this letter, with precisely the kind of super-spirituality I want to warn you against. And it's quite clear he thought it was dangerous too. Those of you who have been following our series of studies will be well familiar with the background of this letter by now. You remember the church in Corinth had been invaded by a group of would-be leaders, pseudo-apostles, Paul calls them. And they were undermining Paul's authority in the church in order to establish their own. And though it seems impossible to imagine it, one of the ways they were trying to do this was by portraying the great apostle Paul as spiritually inferior to themselves. "Oh, that Paul," they said, "he's not very spiritual. We have our suspicions about whether he's even a Christian, let alone an apostle." Actually, how on earth could they get away with such a misrepresentation to hold that Paul wasn't a spiritual man? Well, you see, it all hinged on their exploitation of certain preconceived ideas that Greek culture had in their day. A sophisticated first century man of Greece had certain expectations from those who presented themselves as great leaders, especially great religious leaders. And Paul's rivals at Corinth were feeding the congregation with the easy assumption that these secular expectations of great leaders were equally valid for great Christian leaders too. And the result of that was that Paul's apostolic credentials were being made to look decidedly dubious. Well, we saw an example, if you remember, in our last study. The Greeks put great store on rhetoric. A leader was nothing if he couldn't speak well in public. It was one of their greatest and most highly prized gifts. And frankly, Paul's preaching, though effective, lacked the refinement and the polish of classical Greek oratory. What's more, Greeks were generally very contemptuous of amateurs. If a man was any good at philosophy, he charged professional fees for his services in Paul's day. But you see, Paul did the very opposite. In fact, he did manual work in order to provide his teaching free of charge, something quite contemptible in Greek art. Well, you see, it was easy for his rivals to make the Corinthians feel suspicious of all this. You imagine a bricklayer with a Cockney accent trying to get elected to an honorary doctorate at the University of Cambridge. He'd have problems, wouldn't he? And Paul was really victim to a similar kind of academic and cultural snobbery in Greek society. We saw in our last study how he was stung into sarcasm by this accusation he was just an amateur loudmouth. But that wasn't the end of the problem, as our passage this morning tells us. Even more damning than the amateurism of Paul's rhetoric, his critics found his whole persona, his image, was too ordinary for their taste. Paul was too normal. And you say, what's wrong with being normal? Well, you see, Paul was a religious leader. He was supposed to be a great apostle, a spiritual man. Now, Greeks expected religious leaders, spiritual people, to be in touch with divinity in some extra special way. And this contact with heaven, they assumed, would communicate itself in certain identifiable ways. A religious leader would be a magical kind of person, a superior kind of human being, almost a semi-divine kind of person, you could say. I mean, for a start, they expected this kind of person who'd been in touch with the gods to be a great achiever of exploits. They expected him to be successful, like the heroes of Greek mythology. A man who'd been in contact with God would be a dynamic Hercules who emerged from all the trials and difficulties of life, victorious, unscarred. What's more, in Paul's day, People generally expected those who were in touch with divinity to be rather supernatural, like the classical Greek oracles or the priests of the mystery religions that were becoming popular. He would have had mind-blowing visions or occult experiences, which he'd be able to talk about and, for an appropriate fee, maybe even initiate others into. Supremely, though, a person who was going to be a great religious leader in Greek society had to project themselves as a powerful person. They had to have dynamic. That was almost the word the Greeks used of it. In part, this was a physical thing. The Greeks despised bodily weakness of any kind. They thought that was quite incompatible with divinity. So a hero had to be a perfectly, a physical specimen of perfection. If he didn't have the body of an athlete, at the very least he had to project an image of health and vigor. You couldn't go around projecting yourself as a great religious leader as an invalid. But more than that, he had to have a strong and dynamic personality too. He had to be self-confident. He had to be assured. Because humility wasn't a virtue for the Greeks. For them, humility was indistinguishable from servility. It was a vice. A great man had to be able to boast a bit. He had to be self-assertive. He had to be even a touch proud and arrogant. This is what it meant to be great. He had to project that kind of personality. So this is what, for a Greek in Paul's day, a great spiritual leader, they thought, this was their preconceived idea, ought to be like. A successful man, a supernatural man, a powerful man. That's what the word spiritual would convey. And you see, Paul simply didn't conform, as his rivals were keen to point out. Oh, they said, when he writes his letters, he can be quite intimidating, we know that. But in the flesh, he's a rather weak, modest, ineffectual little man. He doesn't strike you as particularly successful, still less supernatural. And there's a strong rumour going round that Paul has experienced repeated bouts of illness. Well, how can an invalid be an apostle, they said. It's impossible. To be spiritual is to be powerful. And Paul is weak. Ergo, Paul isn't spiritual. That's what they said. Not as spiritual as us, anyway. And believe it or not, it was that particular piece of logic. Paul is weak, therefore Paul can't be spiritual, that motivated this entire letter of 2 Corinthians, and particularly these final chapters of it. It wasn't simply that Paul couldn't abide being snubbed by their one-upmanship. No, there was more to it than that. These pseudo-apostles, as he sarcastically calls them, were not just injuring his personal reputation, they were doing something far worse. Though superficially orthodox in their doctrine, and impeccable, apparently, in their Christian credentials, by projecting this secularized, worldly image of what it means to be spiritual, they were subtly subverting Christianity itself. Under the cloak of being more spiritual than Paul, they were actually offering people a different kind of Jesus. A false Jesus. A Jesus who didn't carry a cross any longer. A Jesus who couldn't suffer any longer. A Jesus who couldn't be weak enough to be born in a manger any longer. And that Paul simply couldn't allow. He had to puncture these self-inflated egos of his rivals. He had to expose the error in their claims to be super-spiritual. He had to show these rank-and-file Christians at Corinth that these so-called apostles could only portray him as unspiritual because they had a totally wrong idea of what real spirituality was. And since they had chosen to make Paul himself the focus of these mistaken ideas, he had no alternative but to use himself as an object lesson to correct them. And that's what we find him doing in these verses that we've read together in the concluding part of chapters 10 to 12 that we have together called the profile of an apostle. It's quite clear that these were uncomfortable chapters for Paul to write. He didn't like talking about himself. It felt like bragging. And though bragging was something that Greek heroes were supposed to be particularly good at, Christian heroes like Paul found it didn't come naturally at all. Nevertheless, the confusion of the Corinthians left him with no choice. Though it made him feel, as he tells us, like an absolute clown, like a fool, he would have to do it. He would have to talk about himself, just as if he was one of those puffed-up, worldly pseudo-apostles that were enjoying the limelight at Corinth so much. But as he tells us at the beginning of our study passage in verse 16, he would do so only under protest. "Let no one take me for a fool," he says. "But if you do, then receive me just as you would a fool, so that I may do a little boasting." In other words, it seems to gain a hearing from you lot these days that a man has to behave like a braggart. Well, okay. I'll play along with your silly game and blow my own trumpet like a clown for a while, if that's what you want. But take note right from the start. In this self-confident boasting, verse 17, I'm not talking as the Lord would. This isn't a Christian thing to do. I'm talking as a fool. Since many are boasting in the way the world does, in this secular way at the moment, I too will have to boast. You gladly put up with fools, since you are so wise. We've noticed in several of our studies how Paul uses irony to debunk his rivals. He's doing the same here. You'll condescend to tolerate this little fit of insanity on my part, I know. You all being so eminently sane. After all, my little exhibition of egocentricity is nothing compared to that gang of bullies to whom you seem so anxious to kowtow at the moment. Look at verse 20. In fact, you even put up with anyone who enslaves you or exploits you or takes advantage of you or pushes himself forward or slaps you in the face. Mere arrogance is nothing for you. You'll put up with any kind of bullying and pride. It's an insight into the kind of authoritarian model of Christian leadership that these false apostles, with their Greek heroic idea of what it meant to be spiritual, were establishing at Corinth, with its typical Greek contempt for the underling and its expectation of grovelling submission from those not privileged enough to be in the spiritual elite, the upper class. "No," says Paul, the sarcasm dripping with bitterness, "to my shame, I admit that we were too weak for that." You know, we couldn't treat you in that authoritarian, that domineering way. "We were too weak," he said, "for that." "All right," he says, "you want to hear my claims to be spiritual? Okay, I'll give them to you. Let's start with genetics," he says. "I mean, you Greeks have always had a thing about race, haven't you? Well, here's my pedigree." Verse 22. "Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they Abraham's descendants? So am I." Seems likely, reading between the lines of this verse, that Paul's rivals were Jews and they were trying to make capital out of their Palestinian identity. It's not impossible, you see, that in a place like Corinth, to be a little exotic in your religious background was an advantage, a decided plus, because Eastern religions were considered very avant-garde in first century Greece, a bit like some Eastern religions are considered in some circles today, actually. "Well," says Paul, "if you Greeks are foolish enough to think that you're more likely to get bona fide religious experiences through Jews than anybody else, let me assure you that my ethnic origin is every bit as spuriously superior as theirs. I'm a Jew too, 100% born and bred." "Let's turn to success next," he says. Verse 23. "Are they servants of Christ?" "I really am out of my mind to talk like this," he says. "I am more. I've worked much harder, been imprisoned more, been flogged more, been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 time I was stoned. 3 times shipwrecked. A night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move, in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from this, in danger from that. Not least, of course, in danger from false brothers." That's a sideswipe, isn't it? I have labored and toiled. I've gone without sleep. I've known hunger and thirst and gone without food. I've been cold and naked. And besides everything else, I face daily, he says, the pressure of my concern for all the churches. Now, this is a real masterstroke, this catalogue. See, Greek heroes sometimes did sort of compile a sort of curriculum vitae like this, boasting about all the things they'd done. But you see what Paul's doing? He's told them he's going to brag about his achievements in Christian service. But what things does he include in his catalogue? The results of his great preaching crusades? Not mentioned. The prolific output of his theological pen? Not a word about it. His daring enterprise and missionary initiative? Well, a little bit of the adventure comes through. He doesn't say much positive about it, does he? All the list of impressive names of influential Christian apostles that he knew personally? No, you see, he lists nothing here that would be in the least impressive by Greek standards, not unless it was accompanied by great testimonies of how you'd come through it on top. Instead, you see, he catalogues the persecutions he'd experienced, all the imprisonments, the beatings, the stonings, the humiliations. He enumerates all the dangers he'd encountered, the shipwrecks, the criminal assaults, the betrayals, the deprivations he'd endured, the exhaustion, the sleepless nights, the empty stomachs, the poverty, the crippling sense of responsibility he carried, the daily pressure of my concern for all the churches. This constant anxiety that you couldn't leave behind at the office at 5 o'clock, but which dogged your steps if you were an apostle, every minute of every day, 365 years a day, a year. And says Paul, how do I cope with all these troubles and all these deprivations and all these dangers and anxieties? Do I emerge like some young Hercules, fresh and glowing with self-confidence at the end of each of them? No, he says, verse 29. Who is weak? And I do not feel weak. Who is led into sin? And I do not inwardly burn. Some commentators, it's true, take that verse as a development of verse 28 and say that Paul is explaining the nature of the worry he felt for the churches here. In other words, if there's some failure or apostasy in the church, it affects me personally, he said. If someone is wobbly in their stand for Christ, I'm debilitated by it. If someone falls away from the truth, I burn with indignation or embarrassment about it. I know that makes good sense. I have to confess, I've never been completely convinced by it. It seems to me that in this context, Paul is identifying his own moral and spiritual frailty. He's saying, I'm not sufficient for all these things. Apostle as I am, I'm no stronger than anybody else. Apostle that I am, I'm no more impervious to temptation than anybody else. My only testimony as a result of all these labours in the Christian ministry is to an ever-deepening sense, he says, of personal inadequacy. Verse 30. So if I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. God knows I'm not lying about that. Well, he says, while we're talking about my record, if you really want to know what sort of an apostle I am, I will tell you. I am the sort of apostle that when the going gets really tough, runs away. It's true, I did it. I've always been like it. The very first thing I did after I was baptized was to run away, he says. Verse 32, in Damascus. The governor under King Aretas had the city of the Damascenes guarded in order to arrest me, but I was lowered in a basket from a window in the wall and slipped through his hands. That's Paul for you. Not the courageous Alexander who climbs into enemy fortresses in order to capture them. No, Paul is the soul who climbs out of enemy fortresses in order to avoid getting captured himself. A coward, that's me, I don't deny it, he says. Don't you see what Paul is trying to do here? He's trying to turn upside down this glamorous image of Christian spirituality, which the Corinthians were being fed by these false teachers. You think of an apostle as some dynamic superman, they said, exuding success in all directions. Well, I tell you, you're wrong. People who present themselves in that kind of boastful manner, he's saying, just give themselves away as false apostles, not true. For real apostles of Christ are men who experience persecution and contempt from the world. They experience danger born of an unfriendly providence. They experience privation born of abject poverty. They experience anxiety born of intolerable responsibility. And most of all, they experience mortification born of the knowledge of their own unworthiness and inadequacy. If you insist that I must blow my own trumpet like a fool, all right, I will. But these are the kinds of things I, Paul, will parade before you. For I empathize with weakness, he says. Unlike those leaders you boast about so much there, I empathize with weakness. I don't despise it. If I must boast, then, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. Well, there's my genetics, and there's my successful record, such as it is. One third thing we'll talk about while we're boasting, he says. Supernatural experiences. After all, you expect great religious leaders to go in for them too, don't you? Chapter 12. I will go on boasting, though there's nothing to be gained. I'll go on to visions and revelations from the Lord, he says. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven, whether it was in the body or out of the body, I don't know, God knows. And this man heard inexpressible things that a man is not permitted to tell. I'll boast about a man like that, but I won't boast about myself except about my weaknesses. And what we have here is quite clearly a description of a very profound mystical experience. It may be that modesty forbids Paul speaking of it, even though he is speaking, as he says, as a fool, and boasting. But modesty forbids him speaking of it in the first person. That's why he speaks of a man in Christ and uses the third person. Or alternatively, it may be the experience was so divorced from Paul's normal life that it almost felt to Paul like an ecstasy, something standing outside himself, as if it happened to another person. But it is clear, I think, from verse 7, that Paul is not telling us secondhand about the experience of some friend. The man in Christ was none other than himself. For he says, to keep me from becoming conceited because of these great revelations. In verse 7. Now there are several things, I think, worth noting about this dramatic spiritual experience that Paul had. The first thing to notice is that even for Paul, such mystical experience was extremely rare. He says it happened 14 years ago. So this was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, not a regular feature of Paul's daily quiet time. Secondly, he says, it was extraordinarily vivid. Whether in the body or out of the body, he says. In other words, Paul felt himself caught up into direct experience of the spiritual realms, what he calls the third heaven or paradise. And whether this was an intrapsychic sort of vision or an actual physical rapture, he couldn't be sure. It was so vivid. It completely eclipsed all normal consciousness. It was, in other words, a vision of the same sort of order that John in the book of Revelation testifies to. The third thing worth noting is this, that Paul is clear that such experience was very special and did provide, at least potentially, grounds for some kind of spiritual pride. For he says, about a man like that, I will boast. In other words, this isn't a normal part of Christian experience. A man who experiences something like this has been marked out as specially privileged. It's unusual, he says. This isn't the norm. The fourth thing to notice is this, that Paul regards this experience as peculiarly personal and private. He heard inexpressible things, he says, things that man is not permitted to tell. So this was an experience not given for Paul to share with others. It was in a very real sense private between him and the Lord. And it was so, he tells us, for three reasons. First, in part, it was impossible to share it. They were inexpressible things. It was not, in other words, a verbal revelation. Like all mystical experiences, it belongs to that transcendent, sort of non-rational experience that defies description. You can't share an experience like that. When sacred writers try to, they inevitably use poetry or apocalyptic symbol to try and communicate something of the emotional impact of what they experienced. But the experience itself, they can never really share with us. It's fundamentally a one-to-one encounter that can't be communicated. More than that, though, he says, it would have been illegitimate to try to share it, because this is something man was not permitted to tell. The mystery involved was too sacred. It didn't belong to the category of things which God wanted proclaimed. It was a personal insight for Paul's soul alone of those glorious things which no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind conceived, but which God has revealed to the apostles by the Spirit. But thirdly, and this is the most important point for our argument this morning, Paul says it was a private experience because it would have been imprudent to share it. Even if I should choose to boast, in other words, to talk about this thing, I would not be a fool because it would be true. But, he says, I refrain. And why would he refrain? Because, he says, so no one will think more of me than is warranted by what I do or say. Now, this is most important. Paul did not want to influence what people thought of him by exhibiting this experience he'd had. It was a personal thing. It couldn't be verified. If he had gone boasting about it, it would have encouraged his converts to hold him in esteem for the sake of this experience, just as Greeks were very prone to do. But in doing so, he would have opened the door to all kinds of charlatans going around in the world those days, who would deceitfully boast of similar kinds of unverifiable mystical experiences and claim authority in the church on the basis of them. Paul says, no, I'm not going to go around boasting about the marvelous ecstasies I've experienced spiritually. Paul preferred his reputation to be based only on those things which could be unambiguously corroborated by observation of his character and his teachings. The things that I do and say, he says, that's what I want people to respect me for. Not my dramatic visions and revelations. I say that's most important. But a fourth thing worth noting about this mystical experience is this: that it was not without cost to Paul that he received it. Verse 7. To keep me from becoming conceited because of these surpassingly great revelations, there was given me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. That's an extraordinary verse. Speculation has raged for centuries about what Paul meant precisely by a thorn in the flesh. I have to tell you, I'm reasonably certain myself that it must have been some kind of physical ailment. Though there are other possibilities. I think the arguments are against them, really. But really, the important thing is not the nature of this handicap that Paul calls a thorn in the flesh. It's its effect on Paul's ministry that's important to notice. Why was it given him? To stop me from becoming conceited, he says. There was a real danger associated with the spiritual privilege of these mystical revelations. The danger of pride. And the thorn in the flesh was a prophylactic remedy against such a temptation. Notice how he responded to it. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, he says. Paul was not willing to accept this thorn. Not an overstatement to say he was rebellious. For three times he asked the Lord to take it away. But notice finally how he was reconciled to it. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. God, in other words, would not take the risk of removing the thorn. It had a vital purpose in Paul's life. What God did do was to assure Paul that no hindrance would be suffered in his ministry as a result of it. On the contrary, he says, the work of God, the grace of God, would be all the more effective in his life. For such blessing, such grace, God gives into the hands of weakness and inadequacy. People would become Christians, not because they saw Paul as some impressive, dynamic, supernatural hero, but because the grace of God and the power of God would be seen at work in his words and in his deeds. And Paul came at the end to recognize that was the best way. That was how it ought to be. Well, here we are then. Paul the clown. The clown who glimpsed heaven. His answer, you see, to these rivals who accused him of not being spiritual enough isn't to try and compete with them, but by a blend of irony and paradox to show them that their ideas of spirituality and his were poles apart. It simply isn't true, he says, to say that to be spiritual is to project an image of superiority and supernaturalism and power. Now, on the contrary, he says, real spirituality looks ordinary. Real spirituality looks weak. Even as Christ looked ordinary, looked weak when he lay in the manger. This is the very genius of the Christian faith. That the Word of Heaven becomes flesh and dwells among us. I don't know how you feel, but I want to suggest to you that these verses are of enormous relevance to us. For you know as well as I do that the kind of super spirituality which Paul is describing here, answering here, is very far from absent in our 20th century. There are plenty of leaders and Christians in the church today who want to surround themselves with a very similar kind of supernatural aura that these Corinthian leaders wanted to, who feel that to be spiritual must mean that you project some kind of glow with miracles and healings and visions and revelations of all kinds exuding from every pore of you. This is what it means to be a spiritual man. You know as well as I do, there are plenty in the church today who want to project that kind of image of spirituality. Now that being so, don't you see how important it is that we understand what Paul is saying here and internalize it, take it on board? Let me just, for your guidance, suggest a few applications of what he's saying. To counter, maybe, the super spirituality of the 20th century. Though there's much more we could say, and much more perhaps you must go on to think through for yourself. First of all, an application about spiritual experiences. Paul teaches us here that not everything we experience of Christ is necessarily to be shared. There are intimate details of our devotional life, which, like the intimate details of our marital lives, are cheapened by public exposure. People who are always shouting their mouth off about the revelations and the experience they've had, you must be suspicious of them. For it is reticence in such matters, which is a mark of real spirituality. Second, a word of application about ecstatic experiences, experiences that are supernormal, even for Christians. It's clear from Paul's example here that mystical experiences can be authentic, isn't it? We're not to rationalize such experiences or to label mystics as demonically inspired or self-deluded. Christians down through the ages have known extraordinary experiences caught up to the third heaven. We do not have to deny that. But here's the important thing. A mystical experience is not the basis for evaluating a person's spirituality. It's quite clear, as far as Paul was concerned, claims to this kind of experience were an irrelevance to his reputation. Deeds and words, he said, they are what mattered, not psychic ecstasies. I refrain from talking about these things so no one will think more of me than is warranted by what I do or say. Something else about such experiences. They are not to be sought after. Paul didn't seek after them. It just happened to him, out of the blue. One day, 14 years ago, he was caught up, he says. It wasn't because he'd gone through some kind of mystical discipline, or prayed for months and months on end, fasting in the desert. He didn't try to generate this experience. It happened to him, and it never happened again. So as we know, even in the greatest saints, you see, such experiences were rare or even totally absent. Because it's character, not experience, that really shows the mark of the Spirit in a man's life. Listen to these words from St. John of the Cross, one of the greatest Christian mystics of all times. This is what he says. All visions, revelations, heavenly feelings, and whatever is greater than these, are not worth the least act of humility, being the fruits of that charity which neither values nor seeks itself, which thinketh well not of self but of others. Many souls, he says, to whom visions have never come, are incomparably more advanced in the way of perfection than others, to whom many have been given. So important we understand that, lest we feel ourselves inferior because we don't have visions. Another little application that will counteract some of the super spirituality of our day. Paul teaches us here that the prayers, even of the greatest saints, are sometimes not answered in the way they want. Three times Paul asked for something, and three times God said no. Well, take comfort from that. There are those who will tell us that if our prayers aren't answered, it's simply because we haven't got enough faith. That we should work ourselves up emotionally more in our praying. Or get more people gathered together to pray for the thing, because clearly there aren't enough of us praying. Well, you see, contrary to pagan ideas, prayer is not a magic wish granted unconditionally by some kind of fairy godmother. Prayer is a gracious gift from a caring God. And there is no way that caring Father God is going to give us something he knows isn't good for us, no matter how long we badger him for it, no matter how many of us gang up on him for it, no matter how much of a frenzy we work ourselves into over it. If Paul had gone on asking for this 50 times, he would have still said no. Even Jesus prayed once, take this cup from me, and got the answer no. Thank goodness God sometimes says no. Aren't you glad your parents sometimes said no? Even the greatest saints sometimes do not have their prayers answered. For prayer is not magic wishes. Another little line of application that I think is important in today's climate. Suffering. Suffering is something Christians must be prepared to accept into their lives for the positive contribution it can make to their ministry. Sometimes. Paul had to accept his thorn in the flesh. Now again, you see, there are some folk who will tell us we have a right to be healed. That if we're sick and we're not healed, there must be something wrong with us. Not so. There is an expectation of suffering in the Christian of life. Of course we pray for relief. But if our prayers are persistently declined, then we have to eventually come to the conclusion that maybe God is saying to us, you are more useful to me with suffering than without it. For that can be true. There are qualities we learn by means of suffering that we learn no other way. Even Christ, we're told, was made perfect through the things he suffered. God's grace in us is sometimes only brought to its peak of fulfillment through the experience of crippling weakness. And incidentally, note that from what Paul says here, it is a total mistake to draw a sharp line between Satan's work and God's will in this respect. For he calls this thorn in the flesh which God had given him a messenger of Satan. For some people, to find something called a messenger of Satan, well, that's proof, isn't it, that it ought to be right for God to take it away? Well, that isn't the way the universe works. Satan is under God's control, and it is sometimes God's will to give Satan some opportunity in us, just as he did in Job, to teach us things, not as a punishment, but maybe, as in Paul's case, as a chastening control on our pride and conceit. See, Paul was a better man because of his thorn in the flesh. As far as God was concerned, a little physical discomfort was a small price to pay for the conquest of the ego in this servant of his. But the final thing I want you to notice this morning from our study passage is the great lesson which Paul learned as a result of this thorn in the flesh he bore. I will boast all the more gladly, he says, about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties, in other words, in all these things, which with your Greek frame of mind you find so hard to associate with being spiritual. No, I delight in these things. For I have learned when I am weak, then I'm strong. It's hard to exaggerate the importance of that verse. It represents the very kernel of Paul's whole thesis in these final chapters. It is the final rebuke to the Corinthian mindset. You Corinthians, he's saying, you are the fools. You admire those who boast of their revelations and their visions. You grovel before those who brag of their achievements. Well, I don't. And it was the direct result of the intensity of my own apostolic visions and revelations that I learned this lesson. That Christianity is incompatible with such super spiritual behavior. I have learned, he says, that Christian spirituality delights in weakness, because only in the acceptance of weakness, only in the confession of weakness, do I find that supernatural grace of God flowing to meet my needs? This is the great paradox of Christianity that I discovered when God spoke to me. The paradox of the cross. That only in humiliation do we find God exalting us. Only in dying do we find God making us alive. Only in throwing our lives away do we find God giving life back to us. Only when I'm weak am I strong? You know, there is, in the Christian world generally, I suspect there is a bit of it in our church here too, a syndrome that I'll call the let's all pretend we're spiritual syndrome. You know, you look at the man in the pulpit, and just like the Corinthians, we're easily persuaded there must be something superhuman about this fellow. I mean, he's been in touch with God, hasn't he? He's spiritual, so he'll have no problems. He'll suffer no weaknesses. He's in no danger of falling into sin. And safely up there, 6 foot above contradiction, it's easy perhaps to believe that of him, I don't know. Like Caesar, he doth bestride the church like a colossus, and other humble Christians walk under his legs. And the more he confirms this image of invincibility, the more sure we are that he is a spiritual giant. The more psychological pressure we put on him to maintain this image. And the more compelled we feel to try to emulate it. Let's all pretend we're spiritual too. No problems. No weaknesses. No sins. We're strong. Because we're spiritual. Well, I'm here this morning to tell you it is dangerous. In fact, it's worse than dangerous. It's plain self-deceiving, isn't it? Never be duped by glib-tongued, super-spiritual types who forever tell you about their wonderful, successful Christian lives. There is no room in Christian spirituality for such camouflaged egotism. If you want to be a great Christian, if you want to be spiritual, then if you boast at all, boast like Paul of your weaknesses. Or better still, don't boast at all. Let's pray together.